Hey, everybody. Welcome back to another episode of the Negotiation Podcast. I am your host, Todd Embley, and today I am joined by Richard Kimber, an Australian and Hong Kong admitted lawyer who has helped more than 400 companies enter and operate in the Chinese market. Richard brings decades of experience advising international businesses across sectors, including agribusiness, manufacturing, healthcare, technology, sports, and education. His work spans China market entry, international trade, strategic alliances, and joint ventures, IP licensing, and compliance, making him a trusted advisor for brands navigating the complexities of doing business in China. The conversation focuses on the realities of manufacturing and sourcing in China today, what has changed, what remains misunderstood, and how brands can protect themselves while still capturing the advantages of China's manufacturing ecosystem. Enjoy.
There's lots of ways to protect yourself, but I mean, I think the initial one is that if you're dealing with a Chinese party, you obviously do some basic registration due diligence to see where the company is incorporated, who the owners are, who's a legal representative, what's its registered capital, what's its business scope. A lot of clients get approached by companies in China, especially ones with brands that haven't gone into the China market, and they get approached by Chinese companies that want to be distributors. You need to dig down and check out these Chinese companies that approach them quite often and see what is their business scope. Are they in the area that that product intends to attack in that market, or are they in a particular different type of business and they're simply trying to set up a distribution company because they see a demand, although they don't have the necessary experience.
Home to over 4 billion people, the Asia-Pacific region boasts one of the most powerful consumer markets on the planet. Not only is it home to half of the world's under 30 population, but it's also home to more than half the world's internet users. It's a market that no globally minded organization should ignore. But entering markets like China, Japan, or Southeast Asia is no easy task. Just ask the likes of Microsoft, Google, Uber, and Facebook. However, times are changing, and with the right partners, doors are slowly opening as more and more companies find success growing their key markets in APAC. I myself spent 8 years in China, mostly as a venture capitalist, helping early-stage tech companies grow in the Asia-Pacific market successfully. This show is dedicated to uncovering and examining successful Asia market entry and growth strategies by interviewing the experts who've done it before and truly understand what it takes to be successful in the region. My name is Todd Embley, and welcome to the Negotiation, brought to you by WPIC Marketing and Technologies.
Richard, welcome to the Negotiation Podcast.
Thank you very much, Todd. It's very good to be here, and thank you for that very kind introduction.
You are more than welcome, sir. We are pleased to have you on the show. Now, let's start by having you please walk us through your background. How did you first get involved with China, and what led you to do work there?
Well, that's a good question. I actually ended up in Hong Kong in 1994, working as a lawyer. I joined a British law firm there, which had the foresight of opening an office in Shanghai back in 1993. And while I was working in Hong Kong in sort of corporate, commercial and trade litigation work, the gentleman who was running the Shanghai office jumped firms, and the office in Hong Kong sort of said, who'll put up their arm or their hand and take over the Shanghai office? And so I thought, well, this is a great opportunity because that was happening around 1999. Shanghai was beginning to be on the horizon, but it was only just really starting to develop. So I sort of said, yes, I'll go. And I took up the opportunity and moved to Shanghai in late 1999. So that was really, just sort of took the opportunity when it was presented to me.
Were you living on the Puxi side or the Pudong side?
I lived on the Puxi side which was ironic because originally our office was in the Lujiazui area, which is on Pudong side. But back then in 2000, much more pleasant surroundings in Puxi, the boulevards, the plane trees, the French concession. It was a much nicer area to live in. So I'd essentially just hop on the subway every day, 25 minutes and pop up in Lujiazui and go to the office. But they were great times back then. Really, really interesting times. Yeah,
my office was in the Jing'an area, right close. I could walk to the Jing'an Temple or the Kerry Center and whatnot all around there. Right. And so I was right down at that, at that corner. And I lived probably three stops north on Line 7.
Yeah, I know exactly where that is.
Yeah, I was planning on staying in a place called the Waterfront.
Right.
And I am proud to say, and it's nine buildings that are all 40 floors, right? And the, like the pool and the whole thing, like big community, big gate, you know, compound. And I started the first Waterfront WeChat group. I'm proud to say that that is still going. It is still very robust. There's probably 500 people, mostly foreigners, that are in that, and it's all in English, and they buy and sell things, and they organize Halloween tours around the buildings with the kids and birthday parties, and you know, who's got a good teacher for this or a good, you know, avocado woman to buy the avocados. You know, it's all it's amazing. I don't know if you ever heard of the avocado lady in Shanghai.
I remember the avocado lady. I actually lived pretty close to where she operated, so back in the day. She was just behind the first department I was in. She was just behind me. So she's an institution. And still going strong, you know?
That's what I
hear. I think what's interesting is she became famous because of social media, because that's what happened is everyone started talking about her. And then, of course, her profile just went through the roof. Yeah.
That's what happens if you can get viral.
Yeah,
absolutely. Off to the races. Okay, so let's talk about your clientele. So what kinds of clients do you typically support in China today?
Okay, so I support clients, you know, it's actually gone full circle, because when I was in China, I was working for a lot of the large corporates and a lot of the large manufacturers. So these would be foreign manufacturers who said to me, we want to set up a subsidiary in China, we want to move our manufacturing to China so we can be closer to distributors. And so I was involved early on in the 2000 to 2005, helping them set up their factories and their manufacturing facilities over in China, sometimes outside Shanghai, down in Hunan province, up in Beijing, and occasionally in Guangdong. But what's happened in the more recent years, and I would say this is the last 2 or 3 years, is my clientele has flipped from the large corporates to the smaller startups and those that have an innovation or a technology, but they're not obviously a company of great critical mass. So they're looking to China to be the place where they OEM manufacture. So effectively, they own the technology, and the Chinese party, the other partner, will manufacture for them. So it's sort of gone flip side from having a client that wanted to have a large base in China to clients now that want to obviously remain where they are, but offshore manufacture. Using their technology.
Yeah. Okay. That makes sense. Mm. Now, in your experience, and I love there's two ways to ask questions, even about advice, right? We talk about how to be successful. Mm. Let's go the other direction and talk about how to avoid getting destroyed or having the ship crash on the shores. Mm. What are the most common challenges foreign brands are facing when manufacturing or sourcing in China? And how do brands protect themselves?
Well, I think that one of the best ways you're going to have to protect yourself is to do the due diligence. Because I've had clients come to me, foreign clients, and say, well, I'm going into China. I've got a brand. I want to distribute the brand, or I want to OEM manufacture and distribute there, or I want to manufacture and export. And what I always say to them is you've got to remember China – it's one country, but it's not one country. It's actually 23 provinces. And you've got to work out where is the best location for you, either manufacturing or distribution, or if you want to get into the retail market, what is the best location for your product? So I always say to clients, you really need to do a lot of DD about your product and where the demand is for your product before you go in. And so I think it's very important that you investigate that. You also need to know whether or not some of the provinces offer more incentives. They might be tax incentives. They might be R&D incentives. And, you know, so it may not be that Shanghai, Beijing, Guangzhou is the best place for you to set up. It may be some of the second-tier cities. Maybe some of the second-tier cities, for example, Changsha in Hunan has a very big manufacturing base. They may be a better place for you to set up. So I think it's very important that these companies do their due diligence early on before they step off the plane, as it were.
That can't be easy.
No.
I mean, I was telling you before we started recording was that, you know, this show aims to educate people about, you know, that area of the world. Yeah. Right. And that is just so difficult to understand. So we're here to say, hey, we know that people are afraid of that which they do not understand. Right. And, you know, so we're here to educate. We want to bridge that cultural gap through information and education, because and one of the reasons that we're popular is because there's not a lot of information. There's not a, and they don't know, even if they get information, can we trust it? And so how does one even, like, how do you approach due diligence or supplier vetting for your clients? You know, what might even be, I'll some leading questions, Your Honor. What are the red flags or practice checks that you recommend or other things that you talk about?
Well, I mean, there's lots of ways to protect yourself, but I mean, I think the initial one is that if you're dealing with a Chinese party, you obviously do some basic registration due diligence to see where the company is incorporated, who the owners are, who's the legal representative, what's its registered capital, what's its business scope. A lot of clients get approached by companies in China, especially ones with brands that haven't gone into the China market, and they get approached by Chinese companies that want to be distributors. But if you need to dig down and check out these Chinese companies that approach them quite often and see what is their business scope. Are they in the area that product intends to attack in that market? Or are they in a particular different type of business and they're simply trying to set up a distribution company because they see a demand, although they don't have the necessary experience? So, for example, if I give you a concrete example, I had a client, which is a very large olive oil manufacturer and retailer in Australia, and they were approached by a company in one of the provinces. I won't name the province, but it was a Western province. And this Western province said, we want to be a distributor of your product. So I said to the client, well, look, we need to check out this company. We need to see, what does it do? What's its business scope? Does it have any connections with the retailers? Because it wanted to wholesale the olive oil in China on behalf of the Australian client, but did it have any connections with retail outlets? Was it going to be able to penetrate the market? And the other issue we found was that the company itself in China was actually had a business scope in property development. So that's going to give you much, confidence that it's going to be a very good distributor. And the other issue you have is, as I said, every province is different. So if a company in one province says, I want to be your national distributor, that's going to be a red flag immediately, because you know that they're based in that province only. So they probably don't have relationship with retailers in the other provinces, and therefore it's going to be a very fragmented market. You need to be talking to a Chinese party that shows that it has the capability and has distributed around China. That's who you should be talking to. So I think clients have to be very careful that when they're approached to do by a Chinese side to do business, they need to do a lot of due diligence to see that company can really bring something of value to the table.
Okay. I don't want you to give away any of your trade secrets. I don't need your Coca-Cola formula, but I understand and quite, I think, easily understand why that's important and why to do it. And I like that you told me a little bit of what to look for. I think my question is how do you do due diligence? I mean, understanding China is essentially extremely difficult, especially when you're Western or anything, and you're coming in and you have this the highest level of mistrust that you've ever had in any region that you've ever expanded to, and you just don't know how to make heads or tails, what you're being fed and what's real, what's not. How does one? I know why, and I can see what we're looking for, but how? Where do we go?
Myself, personally, having been there for 20-odd years, I know who to use as local agents on the ground, who to do the due diligence, and in which part of China they can do the due diligence. So I have a number of agents, and I really divide those agents up by provinces and sometimes by areas. So if it's a company in the northeast that's talking to my client, I will talk to someone in Dalian, Qingdao, maybe Beijing to do the due diligence on that company. If it's someone in the western provinces, then I'll go out to somewhere and ask for the due diligence done there. And if it's a southern area, I'll probably talk to an advisor or an agent in Guangzhou, Shenzhen, you know. So I will use jurisdictions. But you need to use an agent who is on the ground where that company, where that potential partner is located. And so that's what I will always do, always talk to someone local. And the ability to do that is really just been built up by making those connections over the last 20 years.
Do you know, by any chance, is there public records that they're sifting through? I mean, is there databases, trustworthy databases that they're looking through and what they register? And I know even in the business that I do today, I have to clearly name everything that I'm into, right? I buy windows and I sell windows. I install windows and doors and things and all this kind of stuff, whatever. And this is my scope of business. And that has to, it's clearly on my business license, my insurance, the whole nine yards, right? Is it similar there?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, what they call the administration of market regulation, which is probably the akin to a company registry in any other country. You can go to that. You can search the Chinese company. You can get, as I said, who controls the company, what assets does it have, what subsidiaries does it have, what is its capital, how many branches does it operate under. There is a plethora of information available about the company which you can access, and that at least gives you a starting point. So if there's any red flags that you see after that company search, well, that can be raised with the Chinese party, or you can walk away before too much damage is done. So very important that you do that initial due diligence about a company that you probably haven't dealt with before.
What about financial information? Is it readily available, similar to the West, more or less?
More difficult. Financial information is really protected. There's not really much access. You would have to have an in with one of the auditors who is appointed to that company. But I would have to say that financial information, you can apply for copies of the annual reports, but you're going to have to use or go through a Chinese qualified lawyer. They are the only ones who can get access to that financial information. Now, it varies from province to province. Some provinces will allow you access through the Chinese lawyer. Others will say that there has to be a court order. So it can be quite problematic from province to province as to whether you can get detailed financial information.
All things considered, are in a vacuum. Is this, all of this that we're talking about, is it expensive?
No. An initial due diligence, the basic social credit information, which is the information from the administration of market authority, is probably $500 to $1,000 to access that information. If you want to dig deeper, or you need to, you might say, okay, we have the basic information about the company, but let's go and get a local lawyer to go and check the factory premises or check the location and do a physical inspection. So I think very, very important, if you were approached by a Chinese entity and they were saying, we want to do a joint venture with you, which means you're going to invest a lot of capital in China, then you're going to have to do that. You're going to have to appoint someone to physically visit, see what their premises are, do property checks, see what they own. You know, you can do an independent asset check. Do they own that factory? Do they own those vehicles, etc.? So, you know, you can get a very detailed overview of that potential Chinese joint venture.
Last question. About how long would it take for you end-to-end to perform a proper due diligence for a client?
I would say probably 2 to 3 weeks if it's going to be detailed, like I'm talking about. Probably 2 to 3 weeks.
Yeah. 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 That's not bad. Are companies typically happy with that timeline?
Yeah.
Your clients?
No, absolutely. Yeah. They see that as necessary and in the whole scheme of things. I mean, your typical joint venture may take 3 to 6 months to negotiate. So 3 weeks of due diligence is not unexpected in that type of scenario.
No. And prudent, for sure. Now, let's talk a little bit about, in your experience, some of the most common mistakes or pitfalls companies are making when they're entering China to sell.
This is what I alluded to, was you need to determine the best location for that. You know, what you need to determine, and you might appoint someone in the market research area to say, okay, this is my product. Which province do you see the greatest demand for it? If your product's in, say, the health and wellness space, and you want to introduce it to the market, well, then you might want someone to do some market research and say, okay, where do we see, in which province do we see health and wellness as being a booming industry? Because it won't be in every city, but there may be more demand, there may be more gymnasiums, there may be more health clubs, there may be setting up spas, there may be
more, you know, competition too.
Yeah, more competition. So you need to do a little bit of information. So that's what I think is the best thing to do initially. If you're a brand that wants to enter the market. But I think, you know, we've talked about due diligence. I think one of the other things you need to be very careful is the documentation. Now, one thing I've experienced so often is you will get quite a large Chinese corporate and it will talk to my client and it will say, we want to do a deal. And they say, let's sign a non-disclosure agreement so that we can freely discuss your product, your innovation, and talk about how we can develop that market for you or produce for you, manufacture for you, or distribute for you. And what you find is quite often they prepare the NDA, and then when you are about to sign it, the Chinese party will say, oh, this is going to be signed by another entity related to us. You know, not the company you've been negotiating with for 3 or 4 weeks. And this is where the red flag comes in, because quite often Chinese will nominate a subsidiary or a possibly an unrelated company to be the party to the document. And then you find out that that party has no assets. So that if something goes wrong with the NDA, you can only proceed against an entity that will have, you know, no assets in case you have to enforce that agreement. So you've got to be very careful when you're negotiating that you ensure that the party that's been dealing with you in the discussions remains the same party in the document. You know? So that's very important. I see that all the time, where a Chinese party will try and move the liability to another subsidiary or a company that has no assets. So quite often you might be dealing with a very large Chinese manufacturer, and then it says, well, the party that's going to sign this NDA will be one of our trading companies, and the trading company will not have any assets because it's simply a trading company.
Trading company is usually just a euphemism for a shell company of...
That's correct. It's probably the closest equivalent to a shell company in China, because a trading company really doesn't have assets. It'll just have an office address and that'll be it.
Yeah.
So you've got to be very careful on that score.
How enforceable is, you know, like the importance of documentation, sure, but how enforceable is it? I mean, is it a shark with no teeth? Therefore, it's just a fish? China's come a long way, though. I do know that. Right, it's not like it was in 99 when you got to Chang'an.
No, absolutely. You know, it's changed significantly, and there's a lot of reasons for that. I think one of the most important reasons is that China itself is now a huge producer of IP and innovation, and China recognizes that IP and innovation, if they're going offshore, is going to have to be protected offshore, and they recognize on the flip side they need to protect the IP of the foreign investor because it's a global market. So the courts, I would say, you would say the top courts in China would be Guangzhou, Beijing, Shanghai, Shenzhen. Those would be the courts that I have great confidence in. If you've got a contract that's subject to Chinese jurisdiction, and then you are probably going to do very well if you are in any of those cities. If you're not in any of those cities, then I usually choose CTAC arbitration over a court for dispute resolution. There's a lot of reasons for that, because the further west you go or the further remote you get, the higher the likelihood of local court protectionism for the Chinese side. If
like
you
Qingdao.
Instead, yeah, well, you know, Qingdao, you know, potentially, but CTAC arbitration, I prefer, two reasons. One, China is a party to the New York Convention. So if you get an award, you can enforce it in China and you can enforce it elsewhere around the world. The second thing is CTAC arbitration, the panel of arbitrators include foreign arbitrators. So if you draft your CTAC clause correctly, you can ensure that you've got foreign arbitrators hearing your claim, or at least appointed to the panel to hear your claim. So that will also encourage the transparency and fairness. So if push comes to shove, I usually say CTEC arbitration.
Let's talk about the landscape of Chinese manufacturing and talk to us about how it's changed over the last, you know, 5-10 years. Obviously, we had a major hiccup named COVID that's embodied in that time frame. And have you seen shifts that change what brands should be looking for? How has your advice potentially moved over the last decade?
If I'm dealing with clients who are looking for non-sophisticated or not advanced manufacturing, then I usually say to them, look, China is an option, but China has got a little bit more expensive and you may want to look at other locations. You may want to look at Vietnam and manufacture your product, or Cambodia, or somewhere else in Southeast Asia, if you've got a non-sophisticated product. But if you're talking about advanced manufacturing, which is highly specialized, then I say to clients, you probably still need to be doing it in China. China's got the sophisticated supply chain. It's able to do a lot of high-tech manufacturing. And this is what I'm seeing, as I said before, is I'm getting clients now who have quite sophisticated technology, and that's sometimes in medical devices, healthcare, wellness, health and wellness equipment. And really, their only option or their best option is China for manufacturing.
Yeah, it's the tooling.
It's the tooling.
And it's the skilled labor at tooling.
Yeah, it's exactly that. So I think, yeah, it's changed a bit. Basic manufacturing, you've probably got alternatives. But advanced manufacturing, I would still say China is your best opportunity.
Okay. And, you know, my next question was, you know, is China still an attractive market for manufacturing and sourcing? I'll still come to you with that because it is a little bit different than, let's even maybe dovetail that. You already talked about manufacturing, and I think we got that. But even for sourcing, what are your thoughts? Is it still attractive? Are we still pitching that?
Oh, absolutely. No, absolutely. If you want to source something, components, whatever, for your final product, whatever that is that you might be assembling back in your home country, then China's definitely probably the go-to for sourcing as well. Absolutely.
Yeah.
But then again, as I said before, you still got to do your DD. Even if you're only sourcing a widget for your final product, you've got to do that DD to make sure that this is a company that can supply it. And again, the other issue is you probably should have someone on the ground to do quality control and quality assessment. And that can be an independent third party. And there's a lot of, you know, companies that offer that service. But it's always good, because if you're never intending to get to China, you need a third party who can go and visit the factory, check the tooling, check the molds, check that the samples have been made correctly, and, you know, before the full production goes into swing. So, yeah, it's very important to have that third party quality control agent operating on your side.
I pay a lot of attention. So for listeners that haven't gleaned this from past episodes, I am in the windows and doors industry in Western Canada. Mm. And between, you know, there's Poland, which is massive in the windows and doors, and there's China. Right. And I follow a lot of those companies actually on Instagram. And I see what they're doing and I see what they're building. I see the sizes that they're building, the ratings that they're getting, just the quality, the durability. It's fascinating to me. And it is definitely something I am looking at importing. And I want to bring a lot of that to the Canadian market. Mm. However, I have a lot of concerns, right? That's a big thing. I can see what they do or what they say or what they post on social media, like Instagram. But I also have a lot of, it's a highly regulated industry. The rise of environmental protectionism also is more and more bringing that into play. Building codes continue to rise and, you know, just energy ratings or, you know, hurricane wind type testing and things like this. I guess what I'm winding around to is how are global rising restrictions or certifications or stamps or things. How is China keeping up and are they keeping up? And is this potentially making some markets more secular, somewhat more insulated from being able to be global? Or has that, is that even a thing? Am I just making this up?
I think if you're talking to something where you're sourcing, they're going to have to make sure that that product is going to be certified as available to be used in the country where it's being imported into. So you need to make those checks. You need to see that their quality standards are going to satisfy the country into which you're exporting the materials or the finished product. So absolutely. I mean, one of the first things you do is check that they have obtained those certifications, quality standards, ISO ratings, and which they need mm-hmm. to have. So again, all those things are things you have to do the DD for and ask for. So I have a checklist, and if it's a potential OEM manufacturer making something for me, I will send them that checklist and say, tick this off. Show me your ISO registrations. Show me your certifications, your Europe standards that you've got, and make sure that those are in existence before the discussions go further.
And how well those match up with what the country of import requires. Yeah,
exactly.
Richard, if you could reach over and grab your crystal ball that I mm-hmm. know you probably have sitting on your desk. We're going to look into the future. Mm-hmm. And I'd like to know where you see China manufacturing and the export ecosystem evolving over the next few years. And maybe you can speak to some of the major trends or shifts that the brands should be keeping an eye on and why.
I mean, that's a very, very, very large topic. And I would only be looking at it from the legal perspective. But I think you're going to see a lot of in clean energy manufacturing, ESG considerations for companies that are operating in China.
What is ESG?
ESG. So, you know, your environmental, your governance standards, your clean energy standards. You're going to see a lot more of that being relevant, you know, because for China, China is now becoming a company that's exporting this technology. It's exporting electric vehicles. So it's always going to be mindful that it has to comply with the standards of the countries that it's exporting those vehicles to. One of the other things you've got to be careful about is China's enacted a very detailed data privacy regime. So there's a lot of issues arising in relation to the electric vehicle space about what information are the electric vehicle manufacturers in China from the customers offshore who buy their vehicles, and you know what is being done with that data. And then on the flip side, if you're a company, say that you're a cosmetics company, and you've decided you're going to set up a retail operation in China for your cosmetics, and you're going to obtain a lot of data about your Chinese customers of those cosmetics. So you might be selling online, you might be selling with retail outlets, you're going to collect data about your Chinese customers. What you're going to have to be very careful about is whether or not you're able to send that customer data offshore to your head office. So you've got to be very careful about making sure you do an audit before you send that customer data offshore, because under the PIPL, which is a new data privacy regime, you have to apply for permission before you send that customer data out of China. So I think privacy and data are going to be something that everyone's going to have to pay a lot more attention to going forward.
What advice would you give to an international brand that is just starting to think about building or sourcing products in China?
Number one, after the due diligence, number one is protecting your brand. So protect it by getting your trademark, if it's a trademark, registered in China, and do that before you even talk to retailers or wholesalers on the ground. So that's very important. That's always been rule number one. Get your trademarks protected. If it's a design, if it's a technology design, perhaps you can protect it through copyright registration in China before you talk to people to an OEM manufacturer. But trademarks, absolutely imperative. And one particular point that I think a lot of companies who manufacture in China for export only back to their home country is they don't realize that because even though they're not going to be selling their product in China and only manufacturing it, they have to register their trademark in China, because there was a recent case called the Honda case in which it was established by the Chinese Supreme Court that even if you're manufacturing your product with your brand only for export, not for sale in China, you still have to register your trademark in China. Or it can be confiscated or seized at the border if there is a Chinese owner of that trademark. So that's very important to understand and to be aware of at all times.
Okay. Thank you very much. Have you ever read the book, Mr. China?
Yes. Tim Clissold.
Timothy Clissold. Yes.
I have.
I thought you might have read that. That's quite a famous book that you cannot buy in China, by the way. Yeah. But yeah, if you want a good look at what it was in the old Wild Wild West back in the days when actually Richard was first landing in China, that one's a good one. That's a fascinating novel.
It's a very good book. Yeah, agreed.
Richard Kimber, Australian and Hong Kong admitted lawyer, has assisted over 400 companies entering the Chinese market. Thank you very much for coming on the show today. We really appreciated your time.
Thank you, Todd. It's a pleasure and, I enjoyed it immensely.
Thanks to everybody for listening and or watching here. If you don't mind, go over and hit subscribe, which nobody does because everybody streams. But at least you can like or even send us a comment. If you want to reach out to us, podcast@wpic.co. Give us some suggestions, some advice, maybe tips on what to do with my hair next time. Or maybe a nice guest recommendation of somebody you'd like us to interview on the show that you think would be great. Everybody have a wonderful holidays. This will probably be the last show that we put out before Christmas. So I hope everybody has an amazing holiday season. Good luck into the new year. So from me, from Richard, and from everybody at the team of The Negotiation, thank you very much for listening and or watching today. Merry Christmas, happy holidays and all that. And we'll see you next time.
Growing a company is hard. Doing it in a foreign market, exponentially so. The best piece of advice I can give you is not to do it alone. When you start looking at the Asia-Pacific region for further expansion possibilities, and I sincerely hope you do, make sure you choose the right partners to do it with. My good friends at WPIC Marketing and Technologies have almost 20 years of experience helping brands, just like yours, enter China, Japan, and Southeast Asia. I hope you enjoyed this episode of The Negotiation, and if you're interested in being a guest or want to connect with me or any of our team, please reach out to us at podcast@wpic.co, and be sure to rate, comment, and subscribe wherever you get your podcasts.